We're going to be talking about music and poetry. And one of the things I thought we might take care of right off the bat is that in your essay, you make a reference to Nietzsche talking about to wish to illustrate a poem by means of music is a kind of an insane thing to try to do. That brings up the topic right away of the difference between and the relationship between song lyrics and poetry. You have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, Nietzsche, of course, is talking about not so much an insane thing as an inversion, which is exactly how he calls it. He says it's an upside-down thing to want to do. If I understand what he means by that, it has something to do with the fact that a poem, as such, has a way of sort of overbalancing music when it's set. He's probably also writing out of the context of late 19th century music in Germany in particular, where there was a strong tradition of setting poems to music, taking a great lyric poem and turning it into some sort of chamber piece or symphonic piece or something like that, whereby the music is supposed to be at least subordinated to the words of the poem. How that can be, in final terms, satisfactory is a good question. I never find it very satisfying when I listen to those kinds of things. I'm always either trying to listen to the poem and figure out what the poet is doing, or listening to the music and not paying any attention to the poem.
For me, it's kind of like sprinkling sugar on top of a cotton candy cone. Yeah. You know, it's, yeah. There's no point to... Basically, song lyrics strike me as requiring a certain amount of openness so that the music that's supporting the lyric can actually shine up through it and color it.
That tends to be true. And or so that the music and the lyrics can become one thing.
Yeah.
Which is the problem in the other situation. They can't be one thing in that situation that Nietzsche describes because the poem already is. And it's hard then to bring the music to it in such a way that it becomes an organic whole. And of course, songwriters work that way too, I suppose. I mean, there are people like Elton John, you know, who work with a lyricist. And either the lyricist brings the lyrics to the songwriter and he or she makes music to go along with, or vice versa. The music is done first, and then the lyricist writes lyrics. And so that would seem to be a parallel situation. But the thing that makes it not a parallel situation is the context for which it is intended, which is a performance context as opposed to a private context of sitting and reading. The poem that the symphonic composer tries to set has already been written for one kind of context, which is the context of the page. And the reader, in the silence of his or her own mind, creating or recreating the music of the poem. But the other thing, you know, the song that's going to be performed in front of an audience for purposes of dancing and mating, if that's what it is, or for the purposes of being on the radio and making a whole lot of money, but nevertheless, it's still performance. You know, the fact is that the context is such that both audience and artist assume a unity. And somehow that makes it possible. We're having a similar friction, I think, in the culture now between performance poetry and spoken word poetry, whatever that phrase may come to mean, on the one hand, and poetry that's written for the page on the other. I have the same experience when I read on the page the work of a performance poet as I do when I read on the page without the music, song lyrics, which is that something's missing.
Yes.
It's not a satisfactory experience on the page by itself. It may be fine if you go to wherever and you are in the presence of the performer performing the poem. You may find that very satisfactory. But if you look at it on the page, 9 times out of 10, it won't hold up. And likewise, most song lyrics, when you read them isolated from the music, don't seem complete.
Yeah, it's a legitimate performance. Poetry finds its legitimacy in the moment of its performance, and it loses a great deal of it when it goes onto the page.
Exactly. That's why they call it performance poetry. You know, that it's for that, and it's usually, I mean, there are surely performance poets who are so good at what they do that it works both ways, but I think that is very rare. Just as, you know, a lot of textual poets may also be very good performers when they stand up to read their poems in front of an audience, but not all of them are. And in fact, it may even be the exception rather than the rule that somebody is really an excellent reader of his or her poems.
You know, I'm reminded of what Paul Simon, his reaction to being called a poet, which he took exception to that because he wanted people to... He said, if you judged my work as poetry, I would not be a very good poet. Mm-hmm. But if you judge me as a song lyricist, then that's where I find my own. And that's one of the things I know... All of us who do play music and also teach poetry a lot of our students right away will immediately assume that we're going to be sympathetic to the idea of them bringing in song lyrics to class and try to pass them off as poems or get advice about writing them. And I always explain to them that those are really, maybe it's surprising them, those are very different parts of my brain that would actually, the part that would be writing a song lyric is not that closely related to the person who would make a poem.
You're right, very different parts of the brain, but and also different parts of your social context. Mm-hmm. Of the sort of web of expectation and desire in which we move in company with each other. You know, you expect something different contextually from a song than you do from a poem. Though, of course, then you get into deep water when you begin to reflect on the fact that originally it's true, as Nietzsche is telling us, that all poetry was, in fact, in that sense, performance poetry in the beginning, and most of it was probably accompanied by music.
We have that word lyric as the history of that, the sort of linguistic emblem of that connection.
Exactly. And so what we're doing now is something that has been transmogrified by technology, basically. At some point, we're given paper, and then people started doing things with paper, and then they had a different instrument, basically. Because, I mean, that's how I think about it, that for the textual poet, the page becomes the instrument. That's as it were, the new lyre. But it's a very curious lyre because it doesn't make any noise.
I think of it, sometimes I find myself talking this way, that the poem on the page is a score for the speaking human voice, but maybe that's not even correct. Maybe to take into account what you're talking about, that most of the time the poem is read in privacy on one's own, that it's a score for that speaking human voice you hear in your head.
Precisely.
While you're reading.
It's a score for inner voice. And there is, in fact, a very long history of that. Not as long as the history of music, as far as we can tell. I mean, in terms of scoring the inner voice. As long as there's been civilization, there has been a suspicion, actually, of the inner voice and a desire to discipline it and chasten it and make it be what somebody thinks it ought to be. Because as we all know, actually what's inside your head is a can of worms. You know, Freud teaches us how to describe that. But for eons on end, people really distrusted the can of worms. And with good reason, by the way, because as we well know, the can of worms often gets out of control. The old idea of limiting the legitimacy of people's so-called revelations, their visions, is part of the same fabric. Whatever church you may be talking about when you say the word church, you know, you can be talking about the Catholic Church or Islam or any church you like. I just use it as shorthand. Religions have always wanted to figure out ways to make their whole congregations employ the inner voice in either the same way or in at least so-called legitimate ways. And so traditions of meditation, traditions of prayer in which you are given a rote prayer as opposed to one that you sort of create on your own, all of that is a part of the fabric of various kinds of authorities' desire to police the inner voice. And poetry has participated in that as much as it's participated in the desire to liberate the inner voice. There's a real tension between these two things. Music enters there in curious ways because music, though it can be obviously sort of marshaled and formed and shaped exteriorly in all kinds of ways, and has to be in order to be performed by groups of people together, when it gets loose inside somebody's head, it becomes an unpredictable and, I think, anarchic force.
That dovetails with something I've thought about music and poetry with relation to the kind of composers like Joni Mitchell or Suzanne Vega or people like that. There probably are more contemporary examples I could use. It seems that when a song lyricist begins to approach the quality of intimacy, interiority of poetry, the closer they get to writing something that actually does feel and seem like poetry, the musical accompaniment that comes along with that ceases to be the regular sort of pop song or something like that and begins to veer over into something more like jazz. So I think of Joni Mitchell singing her lyrics that are very much like poems. When she gets to that point, she's got Jaco Pastorius just playing wild bass riffs in the background, and it's sort of drifty, and the thing doesn't even really necessarily even have a tune, you know. So that as the song lyricist approaches being a poet, the musicality of it begins to recede.
Mm-hmm. Or change. It become more amorphous. Mm-hmm. As if it at that point it can no longer be contained in a strict shape in the way that other kinds of things can be. I mean, music tends to be in terms of its traditions, very shape-oriented. The blues is the most obvious example of that, because blues is formally, fundamentally, quote-unquote, simple. You know, I say quote-unquote because it's not really simple, but that's the appearance. And you can describe the form of blues in about 5 minutes. And it becomes a sort of immediate language whereby almost all musicians who have ears at all in this culture can immediately communicate. You know, you can get almost any group of musicians who can play anything at all together and say, let's do a blues in G, and that's all you have to say. You can play something that makes sense. If I said, let's play a jazz in G, then that wouldn't mean anything, and you'd have immediate chaos, you know. But you can say, we'll play a blues in G, and even though what you play may pretty quickly turn into jazz, as those people are performing together and listening to each other and sort of changing what they do as they go, the blues is an immediate alphabet, you know, and it's a container in a certain sense. There's something wonderful about that, and there's also something kind of devastatingly restrictive about it. If you play blues very long, you can get rather tired of the limitations of that form, and you want to do something a little different. But my point there is that the kind of song that you're talking about has a way of disrupting the simplicity of those formal barriers and demanding something that tends to be more kind of open-ended.
We've talked about these same things over the years. I remember you quoting to me one time that I think it was John Coltrane who suggested that jazz would diminish in its quality the farther it drifted away from the blues. Mm-hmm. Is that Coltrane who said that?
It may have been. I can't say for sure, but it seems to me it's something that I would have said if somebody else hadn't have, because I think it's true. Certainly Coltrane kept close to the blues tradition all the time, no matter how, in many ways, he drifted away from it or in fact turned his back on it in a certain sense. He began seeking increasingly, as we know, musical models from all cultures, and finding probably equivalents of the blues in other places, or just things that were so different from it that he was fascinated by it. And yet you can always hear blues in Coltrane's music, no matter how it drifts, no matter how far it plunges. One might say drifting is not a good term. He was never a drifter, he was a plunger. Right. No matter how far he plunges away from that bass, it's always in him.
Well, do you think there's a similar condition that applies to poetry, in the sense that poetry, if it gets too far away from music, somehow diminishes in its quality? Or it seems like we're actually in something like the same struggle that Coltrane was, that at one point poetry was four square, it was a building with rules, and it had it was very tightly engineered. Mm-hmm. And then there was over the years there have been a series of revolutions leading towards making them more like natural speech. And I often find myself saying to students these days, you know, well, the rhythms of poetry are much more like the complex and free rhythms of jazz music. You know, is there some kind of way that poetry, nevertheless, if it gets too far away from music, it's not going to be?
That's a very complicated question, and I'm not sure I know how to answer it, partly because you have to say, what music do you mean? And then you have to ask, do you mean music or do you mean music? By which I mean, do you mean instrumental music or do you mean the music of words? Mm-hmm. Which is a different thing. And in that sense, you can't ever get away from musicality, because language does in fact have its own musicality that has nothing to do with lyres and electric guitars, as we know, though there's probably some deep relationship there. But in a certain way, that's to answer that way is to fudge, because I know what you mean. And I guess I'd have to say that from my point of view, poetry has got to stay somehow attached to music. But I can't answer that question for everybody. I mean, I read poems that seem to me distinctly unmusical, or even anti-musical, which is maybe a different thing. And to be anti-musical is to retain a connection to music. But let's say there are poets, in fact, who seem very unmusical to me. Which is not to say that there's anything wrong with that in their case. You know, there are some excellent poets who seem to me unmusical. I think, for example, that a lot of John Ashbery's poetry is distinctly unmusical, because it is so much about, it's so much the poetry of a kind of mumble. That that's what he wants. I mean, that's what he's trying to do. He wants a poetry that's living right at the edge of where some kind of vague train of thought might become the kind of thing that somebody walking down the sidewalk begins to say out loud to themselves as they walk along. You know, that's kind of the place where Ashbery's, the sound of Ashbery's poetry lives. It doesn't have anything to do with music.
Well, you know, I'm almost willing to float an idea here that the reason why that is because Ashbery's poetry is a poetry of wit and humor.
Mm-hmm.
And that when the more that poetry approaches that condition, the less musicality it might need, unless you're talking about overt parody or mm-hmm. Outright doggerel or something like that. But I'm talking about contemporary poetry ordinarily doesn't go to that place. Mm-hmm. And in Ashbery's case, I think that that quality of it that is cerebral, although I don't mean to say it's hyper-intellectual, it's just it's not rooted in a kind of emotional wash. Mm-hmm. That's not where it's mm-hmm. going to live.
That's right. And there are other poets who operate in other unmusical ways, just without naming any names. I don't have to because there's so many. There's so much contemporary poetry that is so based in conversational tones that music is in a certain sense irrelevant to it, just as music is often irrelevant to people when they're sitting around drinking coffee and talking about what happened on the news that morning. You know, there's a lot of poetry that seems to live there. And there was, of course, a time when that kind of thing would not have been legitimate as poetry.
Right. You know, that was a revolutionary idea.
Yeah, it was a revolutionary idea.
Plain speech.
And one that was paradoxically made possible by the page, curiously enough. We could never have gotten to a point with performance poetry with music, where it would have had a real conversational element. You know, it's hard to imagine Homer with his lyre, sort of talking about what we're having for breakfast while he's writing. There's a certain heightening, a certain lift that happens there. And it was only when we began to have the page available, but after enough time had passed of poets writing on the page, that the older tradition began to fade and something new began to kick in. With poets like Whitman, for example, Whitman, oddly enough, is almost always operatic. You know, you feel that his voice is always heightened, but what he did made possible poets like Richard Hugo. Let's say, let's turn it back on. Yeah. The paradox there is that the page, which is silent, made available to poets a multitude of new kinds of voices for poetry. And I think the reason why that is the thing you were talking about before, that the page becomes a score for inner voice. And therefore, you can score for inner voice, or script for inner voice, whatever you want, really. You know, if my poetry were tied to my voice and my ability to project it in a room, I would write always a certain kind of way. I would always be writing for that voice. I don't usually think when I'm writing poems what they're going to sound like in the air that way, though I think very much what they sound like inside my head. You know, the sound of it in my inner ear is extremely important. Some poets say that they always read out loud what they do while they're doing it. I never do that. It's always a silent process for me. And in fact, like just now, when I was reading those poems for the first time, I had never read that work before because it's very new work. So I haven't done a reading since I've composed those poems. And therefore, it was a new thing. And I found myself surprised in some sense. And I had to stop and go back and say, no, I can't do it that way. Because I hadn't ever externalized that voice. I knew exactly what the inner voice was like, and the kind of experience I was preparing for the reader in terms of the reader's inner voice. I knew just what I wanted, but in terms of an exterior voice, no, I hadn't thought about it.
That's interesting that you say that, because as you were reading, I found myself wondering or noting the places where, well, I didn't hear that way. Mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, that almost never happened. I mean, frankly, I'll say the reason why is because you're an experienced poet and you're in control of that. That is a controlled effect that you're producing in your poems. It's studied and it's intentional, it's willful. And so the experience I had reading the poems on my own quietly in my room was very closely echoed by your ultimate out loud performance of the poem. You know, I wonder about this. There's a kind of poem I don't even want to hear. But then, you know, when I come to that, I guess that's a poem I really don't like that much. they're not among my favorite poets. Poems. I guess what I'm talking about is the extreme cult of plain speech. Mm-hmm. It seems almost puritanical at times in American poetry these days. They have people who are so eager to remove any florid nature to what they're saying that... It's an American speech which is rather dried out.
Mm-hmm. That can happen. I mean, of course, there are also poets, as we know, who have done that so brilliantly and so beautifully that it's amazing. Frost, of course, is a past master at it, and his great skill, of course, is to apply the old traditions of poetry to the newer American voice and to make it all really fit together. It's a great gift. Not too many have been able to do that. Other, you know, another poet, I just mentioned Richard Hugo a while ago, who's a good example of a poet who writes a very, well, a conversational poet is not quite right for Hugo. He's a sort of meditative poet, and the conversation is usually with himself or with the speaker of the poem having a conversation with himself. You might come here Sunday on a whim, say your life broke down and so on. The other interesting thing about Hugo is that he almost always writes against a roughened up iambic pentameter bass.
Yes.
Which most readers don't notice because it's made so conversational, you know. So that with Hugo there is a certain kind of quote unquote music that is pretty highly controlled. There are poets of that in that mode who are what I think of at least as lesser practitioners who don't do that.
Well, you know, I think that's related to something that Hugo says in Triggering Town, in which I was quoting to a group of students just the other night. Mm-hmm. He says, "Don't communicate." He also says, "All language that is caught up exclusively, just almost totally, in the intent to communicate is language that is dying." Mm. And he's, of course, talking about the language of journalism or the news story. And we have even worse sorts of language now. The news story itself, at the time that Hugo was talking about, now the news story has become even more of a truncated, shrunken down thing. It's just a sound bite. Right.
That's correct. And I think that Hugo was also, this is an important point to make, The Triggering Town is really about teaching poetry. A lot of it is anyway, not the whole thing, but much of it is. And a lot of what Hugo says there comes out of his experience of teaching, years and years of teaching undergraduate students how to write poems. And you struggle with beginning poets in this culture with the fact that so many have been taught to write so badly. And I don't mean write poetry, I mean write at all. I mean, people who teach composition struggle with this, but students have been taught to write something called the five-paragraph essay, whose pure purpose is to do what Hugo would call communicate. That's what it's for, right? But of course, it's not even for that, really. What it's for is to get a grade in a class.
Get by.
And students are so ingrained in a certain kind of quote-unquote logic that to get them to write poems that are interesting sometimes is a real struggle. You have to throw dynamite in their brains. And in fact, that's what Hugo is talking, that's what he's doing when he says, "Don't communicate." He doesn't really mean it quite. He means it and he doesn't mean it. But for those students, what he means is, scramble up your brains a little bit. Let me give you a paradox that will so discombobulate you that you will begin to write differently than you write now. That's what he means when he says, when he talks about writing off the subject, and when he says, write a sentence and then write another sentence that has nothing to do with the sentence before it. Because that's exactly the opposite of what most people get taught in high school English classes.
Well, the proof of his wisdom is his warning about taking the title Autumn Rain and writing that at the top of the page, and then just see what you can do with that writing. Just stay on topic and write about Autumn Rain. And with every line, you'll write a more diminishing, increasingly cliched bunch of junk that finally you'll be horrified by yourself and you'll recede into silence. You know?
Exactly. There's an analogy in musical practice here and there. One of the sections in the book that I've just finished, which this Jimmy Lunsford section is from, is a section of poems that it comes out of my imaginative involvement with the musician Sun Ra, who, as a practitioner of music, was very strange in many ways. I mean, he's strange in obvious ways. If you know anything about Sun Ra, you know how kind of bizarrely theatrical his whole shtick was. But there was a more profound thing going on with him and with his band called the Orchestra, which he kept together for decades. Though not always the same musicians. In fact, he had enormous numbers of musicians drifted in and out of the orchestra. But there were a few, actually, who stuck with Sun Ra for a very long time. And it's kind of strange to consider why they did, because he was so very hard on them all. He wanted his musicians not to play things they already knew. He wanted them to play things they didn't know. And if you start thinking about it, that's a very difficult proposition. Because what you tend to do is to sort of reproduce in hopefully infinitely various ways as a player stuff you have learned. Just as a writer, you tend to do that. And the difficulty is to get yourself into a place where you can use what you know at the same time that you forget what you know.
That would be genuinely, in the full sense of the word, terrifying. It would be a form of terror.
A form of terror and a spiritual discipline. As Sun Ra practiced it, at least. I mean, he made his people meditate. He made them practiced very rigorous disciplines. He would not let them drink alcohol or use any drugs. He would fire people for that. He wanted them all to eat vegetarian diets, although they wouldn't. And he didn't ultimately fire people for not, but he would chastise them for it. He wanted them to be very disciplined. There's a story I read about him where a musician who had not ever played with him before was invited to come in and sit in on a session of the orchestra, a rehearsal session. And he arrived at the house. Sun Ra always got a big house somewhere, and everybody lived there. Right, the whole band would all live there. They lived together and ate together and slept together, and just in the sense of sleeping, and you know everything else. Anyway, he got there, and there was a man sitting in the room where the band was practicing. There was a closet, and the door was open, and there was somebody sitting in the closet. And he sort of looked back there and thought, what's that guy doing in the closet? And he sat in the closet for about 2 hours while the band rehearsed. And then Sun Ra said to him, now come out of the closet and play. And this guy came out and sat down at a drum set. And in the next tune they played, he then joined in. And the guy said, this guy was a brilliant drummer. And I'm thinking, what is he doing in the closet? And after the one tune was over, Sun Ra said, okay, now get back in the closet. He was being punished for having been late. He came late to a rehearsal session, and he was being punished. And it was a rather serious punishment because he sat for like 3 hours in a closet. And furthermore, it was not only uncomfortable, but also humiliating. That was the point of it. You know, I mean, Ra was being tough on him. And he was tough on all his musicians that way. He was tough on himself because he was trying to sort of displace people's minds, you know, to say, now, I'm giving you a chart of a tune you've never seen before, and it is strange. It is not like anything you've ever played before. Play it. He has stories about this kind of thing. He would establish a rhythm that he wanted, let's say, a drummer to play. And he had this one drummer who just could not get it, a really good drummer who couldn't get this weird rhythm. And at some point, Ra just stopped. He said, okay, just wait a minute. And he went out to his front door, and there was a little girl walking by, about a 10-year-old girl. And he said, you come in here. And the little girl comes inside, and he tapped out the rhythm, and he said, now you play that. And the little girl just did it. And the drummer goes, how did you do that? And Sun Ra says, she did it because she didn't know she couldn't do it. Now do it. You know, he was constantly trying to teach people that way.
It was a radio show about one of Sun Ra's players, the saxophonist, who mm-hmm. had just gotten his saxophone back from being repaired. Mm-hmm. That was the genesis of that poem I wrote about John Coltrane. Mm-hmm. In which you helped me crucially to understand the anatomy of a saxophone, because I was, what was it I was saying? They had keys.
You gave
it
a valve.
Yeah. It's not something that they have. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, in your poems that you've, the suite of poems that you've given us dedicated to Jimmy Lunceford, talk a little bit about the concept of what you're trying to achieve with those poems. You're trying to do in words something that musicians would do in music.
Yeah, that's the attempt. And how well it works in overarching kind of ideal terms is hard to say. But it occurred to me one day, I was listening to, in fact, the genesis of it was this Jimmy Lunceford thing. That was the first part of it that I wrote. Actually, that's not quite true. I'd written another part first, but I had been thinking about this in terms of the Lunceford record. One day I was listening to this Jimmy Lunceford album, and I had the CD case in front of me. I was looking at the list of song titles on the back, and I thought, of course, it's obviously like a table of contents in a book of poems. And I thought, what if I had a book of poems that had those titles in the table of contents? Would that be cool? Would that work?
You wouldn't be bored.
No, and I began to look at them, and I thought, those are good titles.
Yeah.
And it just, this sort of, I have this little homunculus who lives inside my head who says perverse things sometimes, and they always come true. Little homunculus said, you will write poems with those titles. And I said back to him, no, I won't. That's just ridiculous. It's silly. So I set it aside. And, you know, sure enough, then about 6 months later, I thought, he was right. I got to try that at least to see what happens. And then I had to think about it further. What motivated me to want to do that? Well, what motivated me really to want to do that was that I wanted to play with that band. You know, I'm listening to that band and I'm thinking, that band just really kicks. You know, wouldn't it be fun to play with them? Because the Lunceford Band, it was an entertaining band. The kind of jazz he played was not like chamber jazz. You know, it was not art jazz. It was dance music, and it's actually closely related to jump blues and ultimately, therefore, to rock and roll. He was there to entertain. He was there to provide a context in which people would dance and drink and make babies.
You know, those were the superstars of their time, too.
Oh, yes, they were. I mean, the people who were in those bands, by which I mean, and when I say those bands, I mean bands like Lunceford's and bands like Chick Webb's and bands like Fletcher Henderson's. And ultimately, then bands like Ellington's and bands like Basie's, those are the ones, of course, that became the exemplary ones. But in earlier,
Armstrong too.
Armstrong, yeah, and that was a little different because those bands were doing a different thing. The music that Armstrong's bands were playing were not as regimented.
Right.
It's all looser, that kind of group improvisation thing, which is something actually that Basie's band did too, and sort of brought that into the mainstream of dance music.
I remember Armstrong talking about how the first time that he and Oliver had the idea of playing a solo in harmony together, actually that he would see other players just finger on their instruments what they were getting ready to do, and he'd just see their hands do that, and he'd say, oh, nod his head, and then they'd sail off into it playing in harmony.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, Oliver and Armstrong apparently had mental telepathy. I mean, there's not much of this recorded, but a lot of it was done, you know, in performance, and there are people's accounts of it who say, it was astonishing that Oliver was always, because Armstrong was younger, Oliver would always begin and Armstrong would immediately pick it up. And it was improvised, and yet they were playing together. Astonishing. Basie's band had that kind of telepathy too, which is what people found so astonishing when that band came on the scene, as opposed to Ellington's band, in which everything is scored. Even the solos are scored. Although they might have initially been in a performance, they might have been made up on the spot. But then his kind of telepathy was to know his musicians in particular so well that he would know what he could write for that particular person. And often when he lost a key musician, his music suffered a good deal. His composing process lost something until he found another musician to replace that one. That's how his telepathy worked. But in the Basie band, as in the Armstrong-Oliver ensembles, it was all happening right on the cuff. You know, Basie would sort of, he would make a riff, and then one of the sax players would pick it up, and then the whole sax section would pick it up, and then the whole band would pick it up, which is how bands tunes like 1 o'clock Jump got written. You
know? See, I find myself as a writer, I think early on in my history as a writer, and just really generally my own conception of art, I was an Ellington, mm-hmm. and I loved that idea of complete control, absolute mastery, mm-hmm. working out all the details, nothing left to chance. Mm-hmm. And as time's passed, I've become far more appreciative of the jumping off a cliff type thing. Mm-hmm. I one time interviewed Bobby McFerrin about scat singing, and I asked him, you're a scat singer who's really masterful at this, and you sometimes sound like Ella Fitzgerald mixed with Cab Calloway. I mean, you're just, what are you thinking about when you scat? Are you paying attention to the melody, or trying to do some particular rhythmic thing? He said, scat singing is like jumping off a cliff all the time.
That's excellent. And so is any kind of improvisation, actually. Of course, though, a musician like McFerrin or any other really excellent jazz musician has a lot of safety equipment when they make that jump. Because the discipline of it, of course, is not in the having thought out every note and having it all pre-planned. The discipline, though, is in having all your skills marshaled and ready to go, and so in that sense, you're more like an athlete in a certain way. You're like a great tennis player who's ready for whatever comes at you. You know, you have all your skills marshaled, you have all your techniques, you know what they are, and when it comes, no matter what it is, within limits, of course, you're ready. Now, that phrase "within limits" is what Sun Ra was reacting against. He wanted actually people to jump off the cliff without any safety equipment. This thing gets very difficult because the safety equipment is all mental, you know. So that means you have to really mess around with people's minds in order to get them to be able to leave that stuff behind.
Well, in your poems in the suite for Lunsford, though, that's sort of what you're doing to yourself, aren't you? You threw down to yourself the challenge of writing something that would handle these titles. But what I find interesting is that you're not trying to develop an overarching narrative in those poems, but in fact they're at a deeper level of meditation.
Mm-hmm. On the surface level, think of it this way. If you listen to an album by a band or by a music, you know, whatever, you listen to an album, what do you come away with from the experience? You don't come away with a story, usually. I mean, you might if somebody makes a special effort to assemble a sort of special album that's a narrative album, something like The Ballad of Sally Rose, you know, something like that. You know, but that's a special case. That's not usually the way it works. Usually you just got a bunch of songs. Although, with really good albums, you come away from it with a sense of a unified experience. And what is that you're experiencing? Well, partly it's the architecture of the album. We know that, but partly it is the style of the musician or the band that you are experiencing. And what is that? Now, that's where things really get kind of hairy, it seems to me.